Right now in the studio with me with this week's Trails Report, Charlie Sturgis. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So what have you got going on?
Well, let's see what we got going. I think this is going to be a great time to talk about all those other trail opportunities out there. We're going to have, you know, basically we announced last Friday that the work over the Armstrong Mid-Mountain Spiro area was going to be completed. It is actually going to be open today, but it's going to be closed Saturday, Sunday. So that's pretty high traffic time. A lot of people plan on long rides on the weekends. You know, we have ample opportunities to go elsewhere. And really, as I was riding in town today, I was sort of thinking about, especially on a weekend like this, you have all these other beautiful trails like Bench Creek, Little South Fork, Strawberry Narrows, which is absolutely gorgeous, Lewis Peak. Maybe it's time to get on the old UtahMountainBiking.com and check it out. There's some cool places, and you know, take a cooler with some lunch and whatnot, and get out there and enjoy some of the other areas nearby. Also, I've been up in the Uintas a couple times this last week over the 4th, and it's absolutely gorgeous. The temperature is nice. The bugs are minimal, and yeah, it's a great place to go.
No mountain biking, though, in the Uintas.
You know, well, you can. It's not. I mean, we used to ride Notch Peak. It's, yeah, it's not, and that actually isn't.
I thought it was off limits, but I did, okay.
Well, it wasn't, no, it wasn't in the day. Mm-hmm. That is pre-shock days, so that's a long time ago. But, so anyhow, that having been said, you know, the major closure for the weekend to be super aware of, because they really have been trying to avoid having this happen on the weekends, is Mid-Mountain from Spiro to Armstrong, Pinecone as well from top down. So, you know, big stuff is closed for Saturday, Sunday.
Okay, you put a big damper on Cindy Schwant's birthday plans.
Did it? Mm. Well, you know, there's a lot of ways to skin this cat. So, I think you can do Jenny's up to two-step, Shadow Lake to the Ridge. Great birthday plan should really include something like Strawberry Narrows. So happy birthday, Cindy. Otherwise, get out there, have fun. This is a great weekend to be out and about. The weather looks killer. And always, as always, be aware of weather changes, especially when it's warm out. Afternoon thunder showers and lightning. The killer lightning storm the other night. Wasn't that crazy? So anyhow, yeah, be careful out there always.
Okay, what about the Wild Trail? I saw that you're back up.
Oh, that brings up another subject, though. We're back up and running on the Wild. We're not sailing along. You know, we don't have all the permissions, which is one of the reasons we always like to kind of quiet things down a little bit. So we are back working on WoW. And the other thing that is pretty cool, it is not considered a finished trail, but it is cut all the way through, is the Mid-Mountain Extension. So I'm actually hoping to get up there and at least maybe check that out, go that way this weekend, because you can tie that into Snowtop, you know, Fox Tail, Skid Row, Lost Prospector. I talked to Steve Graff the other day. It's officially, you know, through, and there's finished work that'll still be done on it. So Mountain Trails, we did the alignment, they did the clearing, we did the cut, and they're going to do the finished work. Nice partnership, and thanks goes out to the Bald Eagle HOA for that.
Okay. Anything else?
You know, Leslie, I think that's got it.
Okay. Charlie, thanks.
You have a good weekend.
It's 8:22 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW. The State Administrative Office of the Courts will be conducting a survey this summer to gauge the experience of people who are doing business with Utah State Courts. On the phone with details, I have Jessica Van Buren. She's the State Court Law Librarian, and she is overseeing this project. Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning.
So have the courts done a survey like this before?
We've actually done it 5 times. The first time in 2006. We're now trying to be on an every other year schedule.
All right. And why are you doing it?
The court administration, the courts generally, just want to get a sense of how we're doing. It's a way to have feedback directly from the people who are actually physically in the courthouse and see how they felt about court security, how they felt about their experience in the courtroom, court staff, their interactions with staff. So that's why we do the survey.
Sort of like peer review here, huh?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So you'll be at the Silver Summit Courthouse on Monday all day, or?
It's the full court day, and for different courts, that's defined differently. In a big courthouse like Salt Lake County, the two courthouses in Salt Lake County, that's 8 to 5. And then in a tiny courthouse like in Randolph, where we were earlier this last week, that might just be a few hours. And so for Silver Summit, I think it's not quite totally 8 to 5, but it's pretty close to it.
All right. And you'll have how many people out there doing that?
One person.
Okay. And so it's just random that who they choose.
Well, it's what they try to do is catch everybody as they're leaving the building. The goal is to get as much response as we can. But we know that people are busy or for a variety of reasons they don't want to take the survey. So we try to get everybody and then just hope for the best.
So is it an oral survey or do you just hand them a piece of paper with a link and they fill something out online or?
We have laptops set up and we use SurveyMonkey. So if a person's comfortable using the computer, they complete the survey online. But we also offer paper surveys so that if they don't want to use the computer or in some court locations technology can be a challenge, then they can fill out the survey in paper. We offer the survey in English and Spanish. So if they're more comfortable doing it in Spanish, they can do it that way.
All right. So what questions are you asking them?
It ranges from things like how was parking or how hard was the court to find to whether they felt safe in the courthouse, whether they felt they were treated fairly, whether they were treated with courtesy and respect by the court staff, whether any disabilities were accommodated, how they felt about the court's website. So it just ranges. And then we give them two open text boxes that let them say what the best thing about their visit that day was and what the worst thing was.
Mm-hmm. Is there also an opportunity to make suggestions about what they would like to see changed?
Well, sometimes people use that best and worst text box to do that. And those draw things like time that maybe it took a lot of time for them to get heard, or sometimes just things about the physical plant. It was too cold, it was too hot, the benches were too hard, maybe it was hard to hear. But it's also the way we get great feedback that the staff were really friendly or that they were very supportive or that the judge seemed to be respectful and listened to what they had to say.
All right. Say somebody's not at court that day but has something to add. Is there any way that they can take the survey?
No, the survey is intended for that day. And it is just one day in each of the court locations. I suppose just general feedback about the courts they could submit to the administrative office. That's not ever blocked. You know, if a person has something to say, they can always communicate with a court without going through the vehicle of the survey.
Okay. So what happens with the results?
Well, the results are compiled, and sometime this fall we'll report it to the Judicial Council, which is the court's governing body. And then the results will be posted on the court's website, and you can see all the past year survey results on the court's website. And then the results are also reported to the legislature. It helps us show to the legislature how our constituents, our public, feels about the job we're doing.
All right. I mean, and do you take action on those? I mean, maybe where you've fallen short or something? Or
Sure, absolutely. We're able to, if we see a trend that in a particular courthouse there's a problem with a physical plant, like I mentioned earlier, then we can address that. Or if they said staff were particularly wonderful to them, then we'll make sure that feedback gets back to that staff so they know that they're being viewed well by the public. But also if we saw a pattern where people were feeling like the staff weren't doing so well, that feedback would go back to the court as well.
Okay. So you're going to be in Summit County again on Monday. Any idea how many survey locations you're going to this summer? Or?
38 district courthouses, and we have a couple freestanding juvenile courthouses, so 38 courthouses statewide.
Wow. Okay. All right. Anything else people should know?
No. We accept all feedback, or actually we welcome all feedback, good and bad. I think sometimes people feel like they shouldn't take the survey if they've had a rough day in court, but we want to hear from everybody. We just really want to know how we're doing.
Okay. Jessica, hey, thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Jessica Van Vuren is the state court law librarian. Again, the State Administrative Office of the Courts will be conducting a survey on Monday here at the Summit County Courthouse there at Silver Summit to gauge the experience of people who do business with the courts. KPCW News Time now, 8:29. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour here on KPCW. In the studios with me, Park City Mayor Jack Thomas, along with Public Information Officer Phyllis Robinson. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
So, Jack, let's talk first about some of the items on the agenda. Council scheduled to approve the purchase of what? 11 buses and a new trolley?
I believe it. Yes, it was. And there was some discussion about the possibility of evolving those into other choices as they expand the contract. In other words, moving to possibly flex fuel vehicles or CNG or evolving to something at a later date. And we'll probably look at that. As time goes by, those choices become much more affordable. But right now, the choice for diesel was the most economical by a long shot.
Yeah. I mean, do we really need the buses right now?
I think we do. I think, you know, the buses that they're talking about, the vehicles they talk about, you know, they start to be more expensive to maintain and operate, and they're less efficient.
Mm-hmm. But still, I mean, when we want to walk the talk here, I mean, given all of the sustainability efforts, I mean, maybe you just wait a year or two, or maybe not buy so many so that you can, I mean, really replace the ones that really need to be.
Well, I think that's what we're looking at. I mean, the ones that we're replacing are you know, fundamentally broken machines for the most part. I mean, they're work to keep on the road. So the stuff that we evolve to in the future, we will indeed look at other options.
All right. Let's see. You also interviewed a number of folks for the Historic Preservation Board and Public Art Advisory Board. Do you need another week before you appoint them?
We did make our final selection and have notified everyone with regard to the Public Arts Advisory Board. And we have chosen Cheryl Fox, Maria McNulty, Melly Owen, and Sarah Klingenstein. And I want to thank all of those people that applied. I mean, it was a long list. It's amazing to have interviews like that for a volunteer job.
You know? Those were folks with the Special Events Advisory Committee, right?
Yes, indeed. And we're still in the process of making phone calls and notifying people with regard to the Historic District Board and the Recreation Advisory Board. So, but we're through with the interviews. And there were a lot of them, and a lot of people applied. There's tremendous interest in the public participating in community projects.
All right. It was just kind of brought up as part of the manager's report, no discussion there, but you certainly have been very active with the What's Next Park City. So where are we with that process?
Well, we've had community outreach. We've had a number of meetings in the library, in the senior center, and other places. And some significantly attended, some not. But we have had more of a conversation with the public with regard to their perspective and their concerns and issues. And so, you know, as you know, we started with an explanation of the potential for growth around us, including the Wasatch Front. We hired Robert Groh from Envision Utah to give us some data regarding the numbers of growth and also the mindset of growth around us. And it's substantial, as we know. We know that the Wasatch Front has a huge appetite for growth and expansion, and possibly Wasatch County and you know, I think that's a bit different than the mindset and appetite for growth we have here. And so, you know, that's kind of a aha, you know, for some people. It's something I think I've known for a long time. But, you know, that's what we're concerned about, is the impacts of the growth around us upon us, because most everyone wants to come here. You know, we've created this Shangri-La, and everybody wants to experience it and be a part of it. And, of course, that cascades into special events and things like that, and the need to have a committee that helps evaluate and examine, you know, the impacts upon the people that are living here with regard to the traffic and the congestion that happens.
So as, say, CEO of Park City here, where do you lead the community, given what you now know about growth?
Well, I think, you know, there... there's a conundrum here. You know, I mean, you know, most of the things that we're advertising, you know, through the chamber and through business is to promote more people to come here. And and we have resort expansion, so we know we're going to see more people coming here for skiing in that industry. And that's a reality. And, you know, we're not going to stop that. That's a natural desire for businesses to evolve and expand that possibility. What we need to do is alleviate the traffic and get congestion on those days where it's a problem. And I don't think it's an overwhelming number of days, but it's a growing trend, because the opposite flip side of that is if you build more roads and expand more highways, then you actually accelerate that growth. So there's the catch-22 of it. So I think what we need to do is concentrate on those intersections that don't work, those congestion points both in the city and the county with regard to, you know, things that reduce the flow of traffic. And then, of course, you know, as time goes by, more people walk, more people will ride the bus, because it'll be a more logical alternative to the car.
All right. Let's see. The council also passed, held a public hearing and took action on an amendment to a housing resolution. Can you talk to us about what that
sure,
did?
Sure. Sure. You know, and Phyllis can weigh in at any time here. But basically, the way the code reads before yesterday is that if somebody had a couple parcels of land, let's say, maybe a large parcel and a smaller parcel, and that they wanted to fulfill their potential affordable housing component to some extent on using that smaller parcel, well, there's no mechanism within the code to allow that. And so what this change allows is the possibility that someone could say, all right, I have a small parcel, I want to commit to affordable housing, but I'd like to have some part of that credited to my larger project that may happen down the road at a later time. And but they have to commit to all of the deed restrictions and requirements of the affordable housing component. It doesn't mean that they've got final approval. They'll still have to go through the normal process of meeting with planning commission staff and city council to approve a later project, and their numbers and their requirement will be established at that later date. So we didn't see a downside to this. We thought the council unanimously thought that this was an advantage to get some of that affordable component built earlier.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about, though, just because of, I mean, I heard of the Pizza Hut parcel there, you know, that somebody was looking at that, hoping to build some affordable housing, but because it's in the GC zone, there's really a problem with kind of getting something like that affordable housing built. I mean, can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I'll address that a little bit in terms of some of the other things that we're doing. One of the things that we'll be coming back to council with, and I believe it's our next meeting, Mr. Mayor, is we are about to embark on really a thorough scrub of our housing resolution, looking at the land management code, our planning issues, to see what are the barriers that we unintentionally have in place that are keeping things like that from occurring, are there places where we think it would be a great place to do it? And is it a zoning issue? Is it a floor area ratio issue? And from a planning mm-hmm. perspective, and are there just other pieces that we need to think about? Sometimes it's just cost, that it's a great location. Something could be a great location and a great parcel, but it just doesn't pencil out. It doesn't pencil out even as a standalone housing developer wants to come in. And that's another piece of the conversation that we'll be having, is to say, what else, you know, kind of what is our role? What is the city's role? We clearly have been doing some development work. You know, we've done Snow Creek. We're looking at 1450, 1460. We're looking at the Lower Park Ave. But are there other mechanisms that we need to be thinking about, either regulatory right. or financial?
And I think I can safely say that the council very much supports that idea of looking for the places, the bits and parts, the smaller parcels where we can participate and put some energy into those locations.
All right. Wanted to also ask you real quick about, I think it's coming to you maybe as soon as next week. The staff has been working on what they're calling a carbon mitigation fee. Are either of you familiar with that? Basically, it's to kind of take care of the cost. I mean, if we're really going to offset our carbon footprint, to look at the utility fee to basically pay for what it costs, that, you know, to pumping and cleaning and delivering water in Park City. You know, we're talking about pumping it uphill, charging people additional, but now we're talking about really the hard cost of what it, the energy to deliver the water.
Well, when you say, you know, how do we walk the walk? You know, I think that's what we're beginning to look at with regard to some of these things, and I think we'd probably be better off to bring a couple other folks
bring Jason
and Matt. Yeah. To come in and talk with you, but they can speak more specifically, and this has not come to council yet, so.
It's in the works.
It's in the works.
All right. Mountain Accord, the council approved that a couple of weeks ago. Park City's spending twice as much money, and yet seems like at least half the discussion is Summit County Council. Why did this fly so easily through the council, do you think, as opposed to the Summit County Council?
Well, there's some things in life that are a mystery, I guess. And some things are even a mystery to me. But, you know, it's a process. And I think that where we agree is with regard to that Cottonwood Canyon's connection issue. And I think that now that that's finally off the table, I think, you know, many people are relieved. And, you know, it was this somewhat... It was a unanimous decision. It was not a unanimous decision for the city council. I think it was a 4-1 vote, with Commissioner Peek, not agreeing with that, and I didn't either. But that's the way it works sometimes. I mean, you have some people that think that's really important to get that information and the future data points down so that you can make a more informed decision at a later date. And they thought it was worth spending that money and moving forward.
All right. Anything else from last night's meeting that you wanted to bring up?
No, I just wanted to make sure that I thanked everyone that participated on the 4th of July. I think the police department were out, and it's a tough job for those guys. I mean, they're all working long hours, and I think we even brought in outside support from the county. And I wanted to thank them as well as all the volunteers and staffers. I mean, that was quite the ordeal. May have been the one day where walking was faster than the bus.
Okay. Real quick, Phyllis, the Park City Municipal is going to be kicking off a design studio for the Lower Park Avenue area. That's starting on Monday and then what, running through Thursday?
Right. This is probably one of the most exciting things to participate in. I mean, it's kind of the brainstorming session of the Lower Park Avenue area. And anybody that's seen this process, it's fun. So I really encourage people to come out because it's the brainstorming, it's understanding the site, understanding the people, and, kind of a pre-design stage before you really get into the nuts and bolts of what you build there. So this is probably where the best thinking is needed from the community. So Phyllis can talk about, what's to happen there.
All right. So Park City has hired somebody to kind of do this visioning session?
It's the design studio, or in architectural terms often called a charrette. We have we put out an RFP in April and solicited applications from design professionals, folks who have development experience, some affordable housing experience, land planning, to come together, who are willing to come together. And we had, we selected 10 folks who were coming, and some are architects, some are land planners. We have one with transportation background, and a couple of folks who do have development expertise, to come together to spend a few days. And they'll start Monday evening with an open house at the library starting at 5:30 for the community to come and to meet directly with this design team. For the last several months, we've been doing a lot of stakeholder outreach. We had a workshop in May where we collected a lot of information from the community, and we've done a lot of work in the from very conceptual design in the RDA over the years. So there's a huge briefing book, and we met with the team last week to bring more of that information to them. But we're really kicking it off with that community piece, so folks see and can see and talk with folks, leave comments for them. And then each day on Tuesday and Wednesday, there'll be a public briefing at the end of the day from 4 to 5. The folks can drop in, see, you know, what's happened during the day, add other comments, provide other feedback. And then those concepts will be presented to council in work session, actually at the library on Thursday, working through kind of how they got to the recommendations that they've made. And then council will take that under consideration. There's no decision being made on Thursday, and we'll continue to get some public input on that. And we'll be coming then back to council with for their direction on how we want to proceed.
Right. It's an exciting way to get a lot of ideas on the table, and it's a very competitive environment. The few design shreds I've been involved in, I mean, I think the city really gets its money worth out of this endeavor. It's exciting and fun to see. So I just want to encourage people to come out.
Okay. Again, the kickoff Monday night, 5:30 at the Park City Library. We're going to bring you back on Monday. Maybe we can talk more specifically, because when we're talking about the redevelopment of that area, all of the parcels we're talking about are actually city-owned.
Correct.
Yeah, so we'll talk about those specifically.
Thanks, Leslie. Have a good day.
Yeah. Jack and Phyllis, thank you
Thanks.
For your time. KPCW News Time now is 8:46. Good morning. Well, with quagga mussel adolescents found at Deer Creek Reservoir, Jordan L. State Park being vigilant about keeping what's known as the STD of the sea at bay. In the studio to tell us how to best do that, I have Allie Thompson. She's a quagga mussel technician. And Mandy Goodwin is a ranger aide at the Jordan L. Reservoir. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning. Good morning.
So the quagga and zebra mussels, I believe, have not yet been found at Jordan L, and you're hoping to keep it that way?
They have not been found at Jordan L yet, and that is our goal. We really don't want them in Jordan L because they'll affect all bodies of water that are downstream of Jordan L.
Okay. Well, people love to eat mussels, but these are like the inedible kind, right?
Yes. These mussels are actually the size of your pinky finger now. And that's the biggest they get. And besides that, they collect all the pollutant and toxins. So if you eat them, you will get sick.
All right. Well, why are they such a nuisance? I mean, they're animal life.
They are invasive. So they're originally from over in Ukraine. And when they came here, they've adapted so well that they've replaced all of our native mussels. But what makes them a real nuisance is the fact that they are extreme filter feeders. That means they feed at the very bottom of the food chain and kill everything above them because they take the very essentials of life and water out of it.
So in place of the bass or the trout or whatever we have in our lake,
we would have no fish. Because they eat all the zooplankton and phytoplankton that feed the baby fish. And if there's no food for the baby fish, it doesn't matter how many times the fish spawn or how many babies there are, they will all die. And then it just ripple effects all the way up to the point where we won't even have osprey. We won't have any of our big cats who come down and get the fish or any of the raccoons. We would have none of them.
Yeah, because there's no...
There's no food.
Mm. So what precautions is Jordan L then taking to keep these mussels out?
Our first precaution is as you enter the park, we have a big sign that tells you and has you ask yourself the question, have you been to Deer Creek or Lake Powell in the last 7 days? And if the answer is yes, we would like you to notify the staff, which is really easy to do as you pass the gate. And we will then have you come down to our main boat ramp where we will decontaminate you for free. A lot of people think it costs money, but right now in Utah, it's still for free. And at the top of the ramp and our PWC ramp, we both have quagga technicians there who sit at the top of the ramp and we talk to all the boaters. We greet them. We talk to them. We ask about their boating experiences. And we find out where you have been, and we educate you and let you know about the mussels.
So after 7 days, they die?
So in the heat of the summer, 7 days of 100% completely dry, the adult mussels and the juveniles will die. If you actually have adult mussels, sometimes if it's rained or anything, they can get a little bit of moisture, and they can live a little bit longer than 7 days. But to have adult mussel is very unlikely, and you would only be able to get it from Lake Powell after being there for months. But the juveniles are microscopic, and they can live in any water. So that's why we have our Clean Drain Dry program, which is really vital that all boaters do. Besides helping take care of the mussels, it keeps your boat in top performance.
So how long does it take to get decontaminated in the event that you had been at Deer Creek?
Depending on your boat, it will either take, if you're a really simple boat, so like your basic tin boat, that will be like 5-10 minutes max. If you're a complex, super fancy wakeboard boat, you're a bit closer to a half hour because we have to clean out all of your ballast tanks. But most of the technicians at Jordanelle, we've gotten to a point where we can do it roughly 20 minutes.
Okay. So the it's really the honor system here, right?
Yes.
I mean, if people don't, it's like, you know, the lake is glass, I'm getting out there. I mean.
Yep. And you, when the hard thing is we have one. We're stationed from at least 7 a.m. on busy holiday weekends. We're there by 6:30 until 8:30, but we aren't there 24/7 because we have families, and we have to go home sometime. So it's one of those of we really want the honor system, but if you came in really early, you're free to contact the staff or call, and there's a number, and we will come.
So what do you spray on the boats?
We use 140-degree power wash or water to do it. That because the juveniles are extremely sensitive to hot water, and the adults don't like 140-degree water. So the trick is it needs to be high-pressured, extremely hot. So that's what we've found as the most cost-efficient way for the state to provide decontaminations for free.
Okay, so no chemicals or anything?
No chemicals, nope. And we're very careful of all your electrical, and we go through the process and we explain it to the owner as you're with us.
All right, so these mussels can also live on, I found surprising, life jackets and oars and stand-up paddle boards. So people think maybe it's just the boats. No, it's anything so, that's in the water, huh?
And when being trained about this and about it, it's if it floats, it's a boat in our eyes. So that means paddleboards, flow up inner tubes, boating tubes, anything that floats. So even the fishermen blow up pontoon boats or little, they all count. And the thing is they're microscopic and they can live in what you may think is just damp. To them, it's plenty of water to live in. And they'll get into the fibers of, like, ropes and life jackets and everything. So that's why we want everyone to be aware.
Yeah. So, you know, if you're just bringing in your stand-up paddleboard and you'd been at Deer Creek and it hasn't been 7 days or whatever, you can't. Can you decontaminate at home? How? I mean, because most people don't have 140-degree water.
If you've been that long and at home, we would like the 7 days. You need to make sure everything's 100% dry. That's the trick. With stand-up paddleboards, it's just come in. It's the easiest. It'll take us like 3 minutes total to get your paddleboard done, and then it's all good. Because you can't get that foam 100% dry no matter how hard you press that towel in. It just isn't going to happen. At home, you can do it for boats. If you have a power washer, you can get it to 140 degrees. Otherwise, we'd just like you come in. It's free, it's quick, it's easy, we're friendly, we're happy to do it.
So how long do the lines get to get decontaminated?
The longest we've ever had a line was 3 boats in a row. But at that point, we get into a really good rhythm, and we can get you through usually like 15, 20 minutes. So you're waiting maybe an hour at most, which some days when it's really busy, you could wait that long trying to launch your boat because people are waiting their turns.
All right. Well, and Amanda, you kind of mentioned in your note that if we don't remain mussel-free, that Summit County taxes will rise. How come?
That's right. Because it costs...
It's in Wasatch County, though, so why would it affect us here in Summit County?
Well, we estimate that the cleaning process of the system would be about $2 million because Jordanelle is a main water system for Summit County area. Yes, it's in Wasatch, but Jordanelle for Summit County is the main water resource. So that's about $2 million, and that doesn't even include the electrical
facilities and your drinking facilities will have to take care of and sanitize the water and remove the mussels from their pipes and system, and that just adds into taxpayer dollars. Back east, where it's really prominent and bad, they spend regularly $5 million to $7 million a year just to try and keep it so that their electrical facilities can work, their drinking water facilities can have good, clean drinking water, and that all of their dams and reservoirs, all the pipes moving the water through, are stayed open and able to be clean.
So these mussels attach to the pipes.
Anything solid, they will attach to, and they will grow on top of each other so that it will be a complete solid wall of mussels if it's left untreated.
So what's the natural predator of quokka and zebra mussels?
The natural predator, there isn't one really. Where they're from in Ukraine, they're naturally checked by the environment. But here, particularly in Utah, they've learned to adapt and really enjoy our really warm Lake Powell water. But they've also learned to adapt and tolerate really cold water that we can get up here in Deer Creek and Jordanelle. And so they're finding research right now is they're finding some perch and some red-eared sunfish are starting to like the quagga mussels as a food source. But that's having negative effects on the fish populations of those species because of the toxins in them. Ducks will every now and then, if they're really desperate to, quagga mussels seem to be, if you're absolutely starving, I guess I'll eat it, food.
Okay. Again, well, some good lessons here. Anything else you need to let people know about?
We're happy to do decontaminations, and it's free. I know if you're going across state borders, you will be asked to do it. In Wyoming, it's a mandatory, or you will get a ticket. So we can do it before you go on your trips. No problem.
Yes, okay. And I just want to mention one more thing, too, and that is make sure that you have a quagga mussel form every single time you come into the park, even if you have been decontaminated, and make sure to put that on your dashboard, and you can get that from any entrance station, and just so that you won't get cited for that.
Verifying that you have been decontaminated.
Exactly, yes.
Okay, Amanda Goodwin and Allie Thompson, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Morning News and the Local News Hour with Leslie Thatcher is provided by Park City Medical Center, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Assemble Park City, Deer Valley Resort, and Promontory and the Promontory Foundation.
KPCW News Time now, 8:58. Good morning. Well, hailed as the Bob Carroll, Ted and Alice of the new millennium, the overnight offers a potentially kinky experience in which you can safely participate from the comfort of your theater chair. Barbara Bretz has this week's Friday Film Review.
Two of my friends saw the Sundance premiere of The Overnight a couple days before I did and would burst out in giggles just trying to explain how funny it was. I soon found out for myself why they found it so hilarious. Adam Scott from Parks and Recreation and Taylor Schilling, star of Orange is the New Black, play Alex and Emily, a young couple who've just moved to Southern California with their young son, RJ, who instantly finds a playmate at the park. Jason Schwartzman from Grand Budapest Hotel is Kurt, the very outgoing father of that playmate, and he immediately invites the newcomers over for a playdate for the boys and dinner for the adults. Or is it the other way around? Soon after the boys are tucked in for the night, the envelope gets pushed around all over the place. Amazed at the stunning hillside home, impressed by the beautiful French wife, and sated by a delicious dinner, Alex and Emily learn the evening has only just begun. Over the course of the night, the characters slowly reveal a variety of personal issues and sexual frustrations which become quite entertaining, in more ways than one. Dr. Phil might have been an excellent choice as a fifth dinner guest, but I'm not sure how even he would have handled the skinny dipping scene. Writer-director Patrick Bryce did a great job with the script, which is witty and unpredictable, and the intense 12-day shoot kept him and the cast from overthinking the scenes. The acting is so believable and energy so genuine, I felt like I was peeking in the window or over the hedge, observing a night about to get pretty wacky. It's funny, but it's also edgy and walks you right to the boundary between comfort zone and creepy, and then dissipates the tension with a laugh-out-loud moment. I do want to answer the first question everyone has when they see the pool scene. No, they are not real. They are prosthetics. The overnight runs 1 hour and 19 minutes and is rated R. It's playing in Park City now. This is Barbara Bretz with a Friday Film Review sponsored by the Park City Film Series. See you at the movies.